Welcome back to The Late Set. We are still deep in our summer vibes here. This is Nate Chenin, editorial director at WRTI.
Greg Bryant here, senior jazz host. And man, I'm excited about today because we're going to open the treasure chest.
Yeah, fall is coming. And we are already sort of elbow deep in new music. Mm-hmm. How are you feeling? Are you okay? Are you navigating this this bounty successfully?
I feel really well because the music is in great hands, and I'm really encouraged by what I'm hearing. Okay. So yeah, thumbs up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were just saying this is a familiar feeling, a sort of brace for impact feeling, because the fall calendar brings a lot of really notable concerts and bookings and then always just, you know, that rich stretch of new releases. There's going to be some archival stuff that we'll talk about in a future installment. But what we're focused on right now is music that is in the here and now, stuff that's really popping at this moment. And we've rounded up about a half dozen of our favorites, things that we are really excited about welcoming into the world. Among them is the new album by the wonderful British saxophonist Nubia Garcia. This album is called Odyssey. And we've got Nubia joining us in conversation later in this episode, so you will not want to miss that.
We'll talk to Nubia, and we're going to share with you several of the gems that have come across our desks in anticipation of the fall. Before we go there, though, we want to make a special solicitation for you, those of us listening to us right now.
You can shoot us an email to editor@wrti.org. That's editor@wrti.org. We will go through your questions. We will pick some to answer in a future show. And listen, you get extra bonus points if you record a voice memo and send us the file.
Fun.
Because we want to hear from you literally. And we will put your voice on the air. I think we are working in an audio medium. Let's take advantage of it. We want to hear you. So record yourself, send it in, or you could go old school, type it out, and one of us will read your question. Either way, we want to hear your questions.
I love that. And we're waiting on you to reach out to us here at The Late Set. And man, as we begin this fall preview, I got to say, man, the vibraphone is especially exciting these days.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about a vibe shift in culture. And in particular, I think a lot of people talk about this with respect to the ongoing and upcoming presidential election. You know, this summer we saw a pretty serious vibe shift. But there's one happening in the music too, right? We still have, you know, some of our more experienced masters, people like Steve Nelson.
Yeah.
People like Stefan Harris. You know, I think, you know, we still think of him almost as a young blood because he was such a powerful younger voice. And Stefan is now one of our, like, reigning masters. You know what I mean? Among our fall releases, we've got two albums up front. They're coming fast. Mm-hmm. And they are by two very different vibraphonists that we like a lot.
Patricia Brennan, her septet, and then Simon Mollier, his quartet. Two different views of the vibes. But I really like the fact that these made some trails in our minds and in our ears. And why don't you kick it off here? You've brought in Patricia's brand new one on Pyroclastic Records.
Yeah, this album's called Breaking Stretch. And I should say, the way that we went about this episode is that Greg and I had, we each had a few picks. And so, you know, without really knowing what the other was bringing in, we each, you know, grabbed a few from the pile. And Patricia's one of mine. You know, she is a classically trained mallet percussionist. She actually studied at the Curtis Institute of Music here in Philadelphia. And she's also got this heritage from Mexico. And she grew up inspired by and influenced by the sort of marimba music and other mallet percussion in the Mexican folkloric tradition. And this album, which has a kind of mid-size ensemble, it shows her bringing all of those elements, you know, spontaneous composition and, you know, cutting edge ensemble interplay and some of that Latin American influence, and then, you know, sort of new music compositional stuff too. That all sounds like a mouthful the way I just said it. So I think what we should do is actually just hear a little bit of this music, because that will convey the energy on this album. This is a track called Palo de Oros, Suit of Coins.
Palo de Oros from Patricia Brennan's Septet.
How about that?
Man, that was a street parade with a little party favors, we'll say it that way. I really like the way, though, Patricia is lifting the ensemble from the ground. We're hearing more vibes as harmonic instrument in new recordings. It's been around for a while, but specifically, I think that language has gone largely untapped. Normally, there's a piano or a guitar in an ensemble like this, but to hear her as the primary harmonic instrument lifting these horns rhythmically and harmonically, there's a feeling that I get that it's just, oh my goodness, what a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
she's really something. I had the chance to see her a couple of times with Mary Halverson, most recently at Solar Myth here, and she's like in the engine room of the band, you know what I mean? And and you said rhythmically as well as harmonically. I think, you know, the vibraphone is one instrument where you can take rhythm and harmony and really like turn them into a double helix, you know? They're inseparable. And that's the way she plays, you know? It's like the expression of movement through the tone, you know, the tone wheel, so to speak, you know, across the pitch spectrum. That movement is what articulates both the rhythm and the harmony. And, you know, she's just a dynamo.
Thanks for bringing this one in. And we're going to keep the Deegan on the stage for Simon Mollier next. Elements of Light is the new recording here on Candid Records, as a matter of fact. This guy really has my ear, Simon Mollier, born in France, now living in New York City. I don't know if anyone has said this before, but that same thing that I get from Kurt Rosenwinkel, that singing tone with just a touch of electronics with this very pure instrument, I hear that same combination when I hear Simon Mollier speak through his instrument. That caught me right away.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think you're right on target with that. You know, and Simon comes from that generation that grew up listening to Kurt Rosenwinkel and Mark Turner and Brad Mehldau. I haven't read anything or spoken to him about this, but I would be surprised if that influence is not present in his conception.
And then to take it a little bit further, the generation before that, the language of Sonny Stitt and John Coltrane even, this is a guy who loves jazz. He loves the language of this music. He's not trying to sidestep that. He wants that as a part of his presentation, but he's not afraid to open the door. He wants to use electronic instruments. He wants to use acoustic instruments in this marriage, if you will, that breathes and that, as he says, reveals linearly the message of his composition. He's not a guy just to write esoterically for the sake of art. He wants to tell a story with each song that he writes and in the solos that he plays. And I think this album is a really bright example of that concept. Lex Corton here on piano, Rick Rosato on bass, Jungkook Kim as the drummer. These guys are starting to develop a language as a band, but also in service to Simon, blending that ethereal thing with this lyrical common touch, if you will. Let's listen to 808, the first song from this album. Thank you.
Yeah, Simon Moulier has been on a real tear the last several years. And I feel like with every album, you can see the confidence growing. This one is just so assured. There's another track on here that has Gerald Clayton as a featured guest. He's just traveling in elite company at this moment.
Yeah,
you know? And he feels like definitely an important new voice on that instrument and just more broadly on the scene.
Man, Simon Moulier, yeah, he's something else. And all three of us here, Alex, Nate, myself, have had near misses with seeing him
so
live
crazy.
In concert.
Yeah, one night, Greg and I were all excited to go see Simon at Chris's Jazz Cafe mm-hmm. here. And I had somehow got the date wrong. We went there on the wrong night and saw somebody else and had a really great time.
We did.
We sadly missed our shot. So, Simon, come back to Philly.
Please, sir.
Or we'll catch you in New York. I should say that this album, Elements of Light, is dropping on September 20th on Candid Records. The Patricia Brennan album is out on September 6th. And the next album we're going to talk about is also out September 20th. This is Odyssey by Nubia Garcia. I feel like we don't want to play favorites mm-hmm. with our release calendar, but to me, this one feels like a pretty notable drop on the release schedule. Nubia's been kind of taking her time working on this one, and you'll see when you experience this album, it has the feeling of like a real object d'art.
you know, sure,
it has been carefully labored over, but it feels so alive too.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that with Nubia.
There are these albums that are documentary style, record 2 or 3 days, if you will, mix, master it, and get it out to the public. And then there are these, you know, novels or films, if you will, on album that are really begging of, as you just explained, the slow cooking process. That's what she's done here, and I think to great effect. This new album is certainly an improvement on the previous concept and will win some new listeners for her orbit. I'm sure of that. But we're going to talk some more about some new picks
after this,
right?
We've got several other picks to come, so you want to stick around for that. But first, this is our talk with Nubia Garcia.
We are pleased to welcome Nubia Garcia to The Late Set. How's it going?
It's going really good, thank you very much.
Solid. It's great to meet you and hear this beautiful music you've got on the way. Wow.
Thank you. Thanks very
much. Yeah, congratulations. Odyssey is the album. It feels like something that has been tended to with a lot of care and intention.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful record.
Thank you, guys. That means a lot. Yeah, it really has. It's quite hard, like, talking about it because it feels like it's been my little bubble for so long. So it really means a lot that you can hear that I don't know, I just spent and, like, took a lot of care with it.
Your instrumental voice on tenor, it's so powerful even when you are holding long notes, you know, long tones. It's like just like carrying an anthemic melody when there is just a storm of turbulence around you, you know, in the rhythm section, even with the strings, like, but this idea of like our hero, you know, your tenor voice is like holding ground in the midst of this like swirl of action. And, you know, it's a very striking impression. And It calls back to some other things. You know, when I've seen you live, just the energy of like club music, but like your voice always kind of holds it down, you know, whether you're playing a lot of notes or very few, I always get this very centered quality out of your playing. It's something I associate with you.
Thank you. That was really nice to hear. It feels like it's so hard to put it into words, but it's not over talking. And it's also like, mm-hmm. I feel like it's a real, what I love about the musicians that I admire, and specifically if we're going to talk about tenor players, they have that. There are no words wasted. So that's a quality I've always tried to embody, in terms of, I'm here and you will listen. Not in a weird, arrogant way, but like in a, we're here to speak to each other. And I mean speak in terms of on stage with all the musicians, whoever they are, who in whichever context, you know, I want to command that space with people I trust to listen and respond, and vice versa. And someone is always the anchor. It doesn't always have to be me, but if everyone's going off, I will take that role. If I'm one of those people going off, someone else will take that role. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be you're like the bass player's the anchor. Like I don't need that. I don't necessarily want that. I want to feel like we're in the same boat, but we're in different places, operating different roles that can switch at any point. And sound is one of, like, as in like your sound on your instrument is one of the most unique and important developments from beginning to whenever, you know, and it never stops. Long times have a big part of that. You know, I've spent my fair share of hours on it, but it's, that is everything. Doesn't matter what you can play. If your sound isn't there,
mm-hmm.
that is what you should be working on.
I want to go a little bit deeper into that as far as sound. I first got hip to the UK sound through Courtney Pine in the late 90s and early 2000s. And
love
and,
Courtney.
And so great, so great.
Incredible.
Jean Toussaint, too, of course.
Yeah, my teacher, Jean Toussaint.
Tell me about him, because I really feel a kinship in your spirit and in the way you lay out melody. What did you learn from
Thank
him?
Thank you. From Jean or from Courtney?
From both.
From both. Let's start with Jean. I think I am so grateful to have had the time learning from him as I did, like, years throughout university, and then 1 or 2 years before I went to music college. His sound is, I don't even have the words. It is kind of larger than life, very powerful, but also not overpowering in, you know, a context where it doesn't need to be overpowering, but it hits you between the eyes. Imagine you're, in a good way, like, imagine you're in a tiny practice room at music colleges, you have your lessons, and that is what you hear directly at you. You better show up and show out.
Yeah,
I'm serious. You better come with mm-hmm. the same, not the like identical sound, but it's inspiring. It's not to cause harm to yourself or overblow or overpush or destroy your embouchure. That takes time. You know, I want to be able to play over a band, an acoustic band, don't get me wrong. But like I enjoy feeling like I don't need amplification, or feeling like my sound is projecting. The goal is always projecting. Like orators are told, right? Speak to the back of the room. I'm playing to the back of the room. And I learned that from Jean. From any size, whatever club size, the sound is the same. The sound is to the back of the room, and it is like pure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was very inspiring to me. And there are many teachers that I had, like Julian Siegel as well. Incredible sound. I'm always drawn to, I don't really care what you're playing more than the sound. Yes, I can be moved by all of these lines and the hours and hours of the transcription that me and Jean did. But he taught me the importance of that, but alongside sound and commitment and dedication to the saxophone and the practice, and also rhythm. And obviously you played with Art Blakey. Of course I'm going to be like, that's a direct, I was talking about this earlier in an interview. over in America, you have a direct chain of legacy. One on one, like you could go to a jam session and then the week after you're in Art Blakey's band. That's exceedingly amazing to me. So yeah, I have like nothing but admiration and respect and thanks and gratitude to Jean for instilling that to me. And I started on alto with him when I was, I think our first lesson was like I was 17. Then when I got to music college, I started tenor. And that was like a whole different bag, you know. We switched who we were transcribing, and it was less of the alto players and more of the tenor players. And actually achieving, sorry, I'm on a massive ramble, but I'm very passionate about sound. No, as you can
we live
hear.
For this. We live for this kind of ramble.
but it's just, it's so intricate, you know, to do in a way that is sustainable and safe and true and real, like. It's like speaking. If you speak like this, no one's going to really listen to you, and you're just like blah, 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 mumbling, or it's not you. I'm not actually trying to sound like a carbon copy of John Coltrane. I am in a huge admiration and inspiration from him. Yes, 100%. But I want my sound to feel like the way that when I listen to him, I know it's him. I want people to know it's me. And that doesn't come by copying someone else. And with Courtney, same thing. The sound is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want this to come across like, oh, you know, if you have a big sound, then it's great. It's just like, how do I even put it? It speaks to you.
Yeah, there's something about the sort of purity of the personality channeled through the sound, you know, and you're right, it doesn't have to be big. Like I think about someone like Lee Konitz.
Exactly.
Who that sound was so strong even when it was very quiet, you know, yeah. Because it was like 100% him.
Yeah. That part. 100% them and authentic as well, mm-hmm. within that. And yeah, Courtney just showed what's possible from being a black person, a black Londoner from here. Yes, you can go to America and play with people there. Yes, you can tour the world. Yes, you can become someone who people want to listen to their music and hear what they have to say and show up to the shows and gather with. Music is a gathering energy, and he is one of the best to do it. So I will forever be grateful for him opening up those doors for, you know, the generations that came after him, alongside Gary Crosby and the Jazz Warriors and Steve Williamson and many, many more.
It's interesting that you mentioned that contrast between the U.S. and the U.K. I know over here, sometimes the music is a portal for us to safely express joy, depending on our life condition and where our environment is, to safely express what we've learned, and also to safely express anguish and pain. Talk to me about growing up in London, when you did, and how this music helped you to go through life and become socialized as a fully realized artist.
Gosh, that's a good question. Taking me back. I think the best place to start is I've been playing music since I was 3 years old. That makes this 29 years in this journey. So in a way, I don't remember life without it, you know. I just remember waiting to get old enough to go along with my brothers and sisters to music school on Saturday. And then when I did, I was like, okay, great, I'm in this club. And then it opened up the door to process whatever, whenever, and also an extremely important third social space with people my own age who looked like me, who didn't look like me. And I would say I had that in sports as well, but I had it. It's good to have it as much as possible when you're a developing young person. And yeah, it just introduced me to so much. I started my first jazz band, as in taking part in one, when I was maybe 11 with Nicky O, and I was playing with like people much older than me. I was terrified, but it was a really safe place. It was a cool place. Like, I felt like, oh my God, these are my people. Like, we get to play these kind of tunes together, and I get to look up to this amazing woman who is phenomenal at teaching and also inspiring us. Music for me in London when I was growing up inspired me. They were closing down all of the community centers everywhere due to lack of funding and stuff, and moving the money elsewhere. But not to get into politics, it, like, those spaces are so important to the way that you grew up. It gives you hope. It gives you, oh my God, yeah, maybe I could do this with my life. Or, you know, if you're playing with a 17-year-old and then they get into music college and you're like, oh, this is a career. Like, I could do this. And that exists for arts in general, you know. Obviously, any academic subject as well, but that's like a clear path. And a lot of families want that kind of, it's seen as security, right? And having other options for people whose path it is so important to see work, you know, and continue to provide the world with what we need, which is art and joy and, like you said, a place to process pain or discomfort or confusion or happiness or a birthday or whatever. Like, music is everywhere with you. It was everywhere with me when I was growing up, and that is something that I'll never ever take for granted. I've done teaching as an adult, and I've seen how different it is to young kids now when they're learning music, the group lessons versus one-on-ones, how that is different for your development. These very, very real changes are changing our the future of the arts. And yeah, I'm grateful for the opportunities that were afforded to me. I didn't, you know, have the money to pay for everything, but when I was younger, thank goodness for the bursaries and parents and a mum who pushed for that and saw that it was my thing. It could have been photography, it could have been athletics, it could have been fashion, whatever it is, but whatever your child or your young person wants to do, it's heartbreaking when you don't have the places and the means to nurture it. So yeah, I could have had a very, very different job and existence, but from day one, music was my thing, you know. It was a place where I felt that was mine most of the time.
Yeah, that the journey there. And it's interesting to think about Odyssey as representing that. You know, it's not just like the next album. I get a real sense that you are telling a full story here.
And you haven't lost the common touch. It's still accessible in your writing. Rhythmically speaking, on the bottom side, I think you guys have cracked the code, to state the obvious, of making that universal beat to invite people into to music that can be an odyssey, as you've said. But is that really the key? Is that the way a lot of people have, you know, opined about how do we bring people our age and younger into improvisational music? Is it crucial to have that beat?
I think you have to invite them.
Okay.
If you're, let's talk about my situation. When I was 20, 22, you make friends with neighboring universities, you have friends from before you went to music college, you invite them. Then they invite their friends, you have friends that are putting on nights. Like, these grassroots situations are how that happens. And that's how it happened in London specifically. Like, I think we all tended to speak about it a lot in the last 10 years, right? About how things changed, why the audience has changed. And it was an intentional, like, you see, okay, this gig has got not that many young people, blah, 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 for a few years there. And then things start changing because you want them to, and you organize a way to invite people. And I think that's still, it is very much still at the beginning of that journey. And now I see it in the realm of festivals who would probably never book a band like mine 10, 20 years ago doing that. That's also how you get new generations and new people, and, you know, challenging the stereotypes of where you think I belong musically. That is everything. It's who is getting the music out, which radio stations, it's who is writing about you, it's which podcasts are you on, it's everything working together over time, 10 years later, you know. And at the beginning of this 10 years, we were in a pub, like, playing music to not that many people, and then things slowly grow. And you have to grow slowly so that you actually have a foundation of people who want to hear the music because they want to hear it, not because, oh my God, it's suddenly cool. Are you listening to it? Cool. Okay. You know, that's not, that, I don't think that's like sustainable. It's a trend. And trends can change as quickly as the weather, you know? So it's been amazing to witness the audience is changing in real time. Like, that is incredible to be around for.
Yeah. And during that decade, as those audiences have changed and as the perception around the music has changed, you have often been called upon to speak for a whole region, city, scene, you know, like, oh, the London
Wild,
Jazz Renaissance,
isn't it?
Or what have you, right? At this point, that's not a new story, but it is an ongoing story. And I wonder if you have any feelings about how that conversation has evolved. Like, does it get tiring to be asked about, quote unquote, the London scene when your music is, you know,
of the world?
It's so universal. Yeah, it's really informed by so many different sources, and you're also reaching well beyond this geography, right? So how has that evolved for you? Is it something you put up with, or is it something that you still embrace?
That's a good question. Wow. How do I even put this? I'm so proud to be a Londoner. Like, that's really real to me. And so when people from all places over the world are saying, like, oh my God, what's going on in London? Like, what's in the water? Like, what are you guys eating? That's real, because that's really not easy to do. And I think the energy and the timing was just leading us in that way. And I'm happy to actually give a portion of a voice to it. There are so many people that are going to have a different perspective and lots of different things to say, all correct, because it's all of us, right? But it makes me incredibly proud, and I'm seeing it, like, play out in the younger generations. They are coming through with amazing music. Like, this is not just about us anymore. Like, it is fully about the generations who have been, like, where we started at the beginning of this conversation, and what they gave us, and therefore what we are providing as a space for opportunities to any and everyone who is coming up. People misunderestimate how important it is to see something being done, to know, like, okay, wicked, we're gonna do that, and then we're gonna do this. That is how you move things forward. And I think it's so positive, because when I was 17 and I wanted to be a jazz musician, the ceiling was at the counter, you know what I mean? It was like, oh, you know how it is. Oh, you're still doing that little music thing. It is very diminishing, and people didn't get it because like, it, jazz has got such an interesting kind of situation in this country. And it was kind of ridiculed over here as not being cool for quite a while, like in the 80s and 90s. And it's so big to have that change, because you have no idea what's going to happen in the future of music, because so many more people want to do it. So many more collaborations, so many more beautiful moments and visions are going to be realized, because doors were opened and hallways and doorways were created by people for people. So yeah, it's an ongoing conversation, and I welcome providing my very small section of perspective to it.
Well, I mean, you're the evidence, you know. Tomorrow's warrior has become today's warrior.
Thank you.
I think I can speak for both of us. It's really obvious that this album was a labor of love, mm-hmm. and you just poured yourself into it.
I did.
It's really, really clear.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your philosophies, your practical experience, and just your journey in art. This is a great record, and it's been our pleasure to have you on The Late Set, Nubia.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a really wonderful conversation, and yeah, just very inspiring, and I'm glad that the record resonates with you.
Sure does. Yeah, let's hang out in London soon.
Yes, please. Let me know when.
I'm in.
You're here.
In.
All right.
Yeah.
What a fun conversation that was. A young woman who is excited about music, excited about her process, and seems most excited about bringing this new music to the people. I'm anxious to see how this record and this material translates on the stage.
I would love to see a proper performance where she has the strings, you know, the Chinike Orchestra or somebody else, but preferably them, as well as her band. You know, that would be pretty, pretty great. Winter Jazz Fest, are you listening? let's see some investment in this album concept. I think it would be really, really cool.
Sure. Well, this next pick that you've brought in has sort of a band plus concept. You want to get into that?
Yeah,
Emmanuel Wilkins?
Speaking of Winter Jazz Fest, mm-hmm. Alex and I were in the room at City Winery earlier this year when Emmanuel Wilkins presented his project, Blues Blood. It's so ambitious. It is so capital A art, mm-hmm. And interactive, but it really all holds together. That's kind of the miracle. At Winter Jazz Fest, in addition to three vocalists and his working band, he also had someone on stage cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, it did not come across as a stunt. It felt really integral to the experience of this work. And if you listen to the album as a complete statement, you'll be able to do that when it drops on September 20th on Blue Note. You will understand that it really is like one piece. You know, it is this meditation on vulnerability and on interiority.
Mm.
There is a kind of political dimension to it, but it's really like this statement about existing in the world, mm-hmm. you know, like, and being vulnerable. Why don't we hear a bit of the first single from this album, which is called Afterlife Residence Time.
Emmanuel Wilkins on The Late Set with June McDoom and Cecile McLaurin-Salvant. Afterlife Residence Time is the tune there from his forthcoming album out September 20th. First of all, I'm going to have to save some ducats because there are a lot of albums coming out day.
Yeah. This one feels so special to me.
Yeah.
It has a lot, as I said, a lot going on. The title, you know, it's worth saying that the title, Blues Blood, it is a reference to a quote from Daniel Hamm, who was a member of the Harlem Six.
Mm-hmm.
As young boys, they were falsely accused of murder in 1964 and severely beaten by prison guards while they were waiting for their trial. And so his quote was, "I had to open the bruise up and let some of the blues blood come out to show them."
My God.
You know, and this is while he was like trying to get some medical attention.
Mm-hmm.
So like Emmanuel took that quote and really kind of made it, he sort of internalized it, you know, and he was thinking about the blues mm-hmm. and all of the sort of associations we have with the blues as both a mode of resilience, but also as a state of being mm-hmm. and also as like a form of sort of oppressive energies, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And similarly with blood, he's thinking about ancestry and lineage, but also like an open wound, you know? So mm-hmm. it's like a very emotional and very like visceral kind of reflection on the struggle, mm-hmm. the African-American struggle in this country then and now, ongoing.
Yes, that's great, man. I can't wait to hear this whole project. Blues Blood from Emmanuel Wilkins. Next is Chris Davis, and we kind of fought over this. So if Chris is listening, we kind of passed the football around. But, man, we both are thumbs up on this brand-new trio outing, Run the Gauntlet. And let me say, before I say anything about this album, this combination of players is already really special, but I think it's a bird's eye into taking material that we would classify as avant-garde or slightly left. With super swinging groove masters, there's an accessibility to mm-hmm. this avant-garde that I feel is distinct in some ways from some avant-garde that is great, but maybe doesn't have the grounding that mm-hmm. this album has.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way to put it. You know, Chris Davis is a pianist who has, you know, she's worked on both sides of that. I don't want to call it a divide. Mm-hmm, you know, she's. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that she has roamed freely in her approach. She can be as out gets, and she can really dig in.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we should come out and say it, Greg. Who's on this record?
sure. Bob Hurst as the bassist here. And Philadelphia's own, now world-renowned, Jonathan Blake
yeah.
on drums and cymbals. Let's drop the needle on this and come back and talk about it some. This is the title track to Run the Gauntlet.
It's really cool to hear Chris in this setting because she is, you know, I think it's fair to say, like Jerry Allen, someone that she mm-hmm. has specifically paid tribute to, she's just like able to both hunker down and be in the middle of the maelstrom.
Yeah.
But also like kind of float above it a bit and see the whole terrain, mm-hmm. you know, like she's mm-hmm. she's got this kind of strategic view on the situation. And so she can both be in the mix and above it in a certain way that I think is very, very tricky.
There's
a handful of people I can point to on the piano mm-hmm. who I feel like have that ability. Jason Moran is another one, mm-hmm. you know, to like see the big picture while like stirring it up at the same time.
Yeah, that's a great point, man. And I do think it may point back to the security and surety of the rhythm section.
Mm-hmm.
you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we would be remiss not to mention the six artists that Chris Davis directly tributes on this album. With her original work, yes, but it's inspired by Jerry Allen, who you mentioned, Carla Bley, Marilyn Crispell, Angelica Sanchez, Sylvie Cavossier, and also Rennie Rosness.
Yeah.
Examining these women as musicians, some of them as mothers, as human beings, specifically, comprehensive people. I think the music does a great job at representing the totality of what it means to be a human who's just also an exceptional musician.
Yeah, yeah, like navigating life. I mean, is that, I haven't looked into this, is Run the Gauntlet a reference to the sort of that ability to, like, you know, be a performing artist
yep.
and then also, like, suffering the slings and arrows that life has to throw at you?
Agreed, absolutely. And you really hear that specifically with these timing shifts and dynamic shifts. And this is just an odyssey all by itself. To borrow Nubia's album title,
yeah.
I really get that sense when listening to this song. It could have almost been its own thing. But no, listen deeper into this album. You'll hear prepared piano. You'll hear this, again, really sensitive rhythmic accompaniment under someone who we both feel is becoming a true visionary on these 88s. Chris Davis, again, Run the Gauntlet, coming on Pyroclastic Records.
That is a September 27th release. So mm-hmm. mark your calendar for that. Yeah, we're all about it. And our next album is an October release. This is dropping October 11th on Royal Potato Family Records.
Ah.
This is by the violinist Jenny Scheinman. It's called All Species Parade. And Greg, you know me. I am a sucker for the kind of, like, rooted, sort of almost rustic feeling.
Yes.
But also, like, free and exploratory that Jenny Scheinman has access to, mm-hmm. you know. In a previous episode of this show, we talked with Allison Miller, one of her closest collaborators. And Allison is someone else who, like, owns this vibe, you know, where it's like, it feels kind of homey, but it also is like, it'll knock you back,
mm-hmm.
you know? And Jenny does that on this record. It's got a real kind of, like, California, like, landscape vibe. You know, she comes from a particular place, like Humboldt County.
Mm.
And she evokes some of that. But as usual, she's got just a really amazing family on this record. She works with the pianist Carmen Staff. And she's got not one, but three amazing guitarists rotating in and out. Bill Frisell, Nels Klein, Julian Lodge.
Wow.
And then she's got one of Frisell's old rhythm sections, Tony Scheer on bass and Kenny Wallison on drums. So, you know, if you like Bill Frisell, if you like Julian Lodge, you're going to like this.
Yeah. Man, I've always been impressed by Royal Potato Family and the eclecticism that their artists are able to display. It must be awesome, again, to have a musical family like you've just outlined to come together to lead the charge. But man, Jenny is really distinctive as a voice on this instrument. You know, we think about, you know, the violin in jazz. You know, a lot of people say they love it. A lot of people don't like it so much. But I've always found solace in Jenny's playing in combining just those elements that you talked about, this kind of homespun thing with this sophistication thing.
Right.
And the people that she is surrounding herself with project after project really helps her to bring out her concept. She knows how to pick these lineups to get her vision across.
Yeah. Let's hear a bit of the opening track from this album, which has an enticing title, Ornette Goes Home.
Hey.
So, Greg, Ornette Goes Home, you may think that this is a song about your cat.
That's right. I'm going to play this for him. He may be a new convert to Jenny Scheinman soon.
Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't be? There's such a, you know, Jenny does this thing that we've seen some other people do, which is locate the kind of the irresistible sing-song quality in Ornette Coleman's music. Mm-hmm. You know, like Ornette's music is like, at its core, those melodies are the furthest thing from inaccessible. You
That's
know what
right.
I mean? They're
That's
kind
right.
of like, they get stuck in your head.
They do.
You know? And she really brings that to the fore on this track. And, you know, elsewhere on this album, there's like different kinds of groove. There's a tune that has a kind of Henry Mancini character to it. You know, she's really like having fun exploring different colors and tonalities with the ensemble. And I say ensemble because it really is a group effort. You know, all those bold-faced names I just mentioned, like they really do function as a family. Mm. And she's kind of bringing out the best of that energy on this record.
Jenny Scheinman on the late set. And this comes out in October, right?
This one is an October 11th release.
And for November, you mentioned at the top of the show, Nate, a bit of a vibe shift going mm-hmm. on in the country.
Yes, sir.
We're crossing our fingers and toes, many of us, that that vibe shift becomes a reality somewhere around November 5th or so. But a few days after that, we may just be in for several days of partying. And I've got just the soundtrack for that. You know, earlier this year, we lost an icon in that of Les McCann. A guy who I got to know a little bit in his last year of life, loved his music for a lifetime. But two gentlemen here who were very, very close to Les are doing a bit of their own tribute in pianist Joe Alterman and the producer Motion Worker. You may know, or many of our listeners may know Motion Worker also as Adam Dorn, whose father, Joel Dorn, was Les's producer on Atlantic Records for some 25 years plus. But Joe Alterman, he's been a darling at jazz radio, playing these amazingly funky, groovy, swinging albums. But this is definitely a departure in that both of these gents are friends. But Motion Worker is a vibe creator. He uses electronica to basically background, if you will, these danceable, club-like productions, something that we've never heard Joe Alterman inhabit creatively until now. So we have For Less, an album coming out November the 8th. And man, it's a party and good time. That's the best way I can say it. Joe plays all the piano. You'll hear these remnants of Ramsey Lewis and Les McCann and Bobby Timmons, basically over these partying, danceable music beds that Motion Worker creates. You may know his work from the Richard Pryor documentary on film a few years ago. He knows how to set a groove, and he knows how to give it the character of yesteryear. It's a thing where we have this eclecticism without being weird. That's how I want to say it. So let's drop the needle really quick on this tune. Let me tell you something. This is Joe Alterman and Motion Worker tributing Les McCann.
All right. He's a pianist, composer. He's a photographer. He's a painter. He's a man who does many things, and he does them all well. Mr. Les McCann.
Eclectic, but not weird. I believe that is the official Democratic Party platform this season. Eclectic, but not weird.
Yeah.
I, you know, as you're playing that track, I felt like I was actually listening to The Get Down Saturdays on WRTI. It was like, okay, mm-hmm. I know where this is going.
You know exactly where.
But I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can only imagine the conversations in the studio and during the planning for this album, given that Adam Dorn and Joe Alterman, you know, at different points in their lives were really close to Les McCann. And so they had a lot to talk about there. But given that Motion Worker, Adam Dorn, is like, you know, working with this as a producer and working with samples and so on, I wonder, like, do you feel like this album really actively engages with the life that Les McCann's music has had as samples? Mm. You know, like his music has been used by Snoop Dogg, by Warren G, mm-hmm. by a bunch of other people. And my impression is that he was like, that's cool. Like, but he didn't really think about that himself too much. But clearly Adam Dorn is somebody who probably did, you know? And so I wondered, like, how do we, where do we place that sort of reference point in this album?
I think this album has some touchstones of Les that have not been used. More specifically, we hear Les's voice, which was not, but could have been sampled throughout the years. You have sort of a sense of lightness or humor that a lot of those samples were more along like dark sounds, if you will. This gritty kind of New York hip hop or West Coast hip hop in some instances that Les's music was used for. But I didn't really get the celebratory essence of Les's music in those previous examples. I got some seriously funky samples from that. But here I think we have, again, a tribute without being cliche. This is like, who was Les McCann? He was a jubilant guy that loved to tell dirty jokes, that always had you cracking up, that basically the piano was, you know, it could have been any instrument. He just happened to land on the piano. So that's the spirit we have here, something that is fun, partying. It really is almost a musical portrait with only, I think, covering one of Les's songs. The majority of these are original compositions. So I like the fact that we hear Joe in a completely different light than a piano trio, and we have Motion Worker working with one live musician that is basically the foundation of these samples to kind of swirl around them. So it's new for both of these guys. And I think it also tributes Les in a way that celebrates his personality in ways maybe that we haven't heard in previous samples.
Well, it's that's really, really beautiful because, you know, as you said, we lost him. The music lives, but it's nice to hear his actual voice and the life in that voice in a new context. And I think that brings us to the end of our actual highlight picks. But we want to say that there is a lot of stuff coming out.
Oh, my goodness.
Just to toss out a few other names. You know, we're also looking ahead to albums by Philadelphia's own George Burton.
Yes.
He's got an album called White Noise coming out September 20th. There's something out from the clarinetist and saxophonist Anat Cohen. Her group Quartetino is releasing an album called Bloom on September 27th. Greg, what else you got?
Oh, man, I want to put a spotlight on Walter Smith III.
Yes, sir.
Three of us are from Houston, and Ruben is not.
Classic.
Oh, man. That comes out on Blue Note Records on September 27th. Also, new music on the way from bassist, producer also, Joe Sanders. He'll be out in October. And there is a couple of, there are a couple of embargoed releases that, man, I am just really sitting on my hands that I can't talk about.
We will be, if not spilling the beans, we will be cooking some beans on an upcoming episode of The Late Set. We are excited about some other things that we cannot yet disclose. And we also are excited, I'll say again, to hear from you.
Yes.
What do you want to hear us talk about? What questions do you have? Don't be shy. Drop us a line, record a voice memo, or write us an email.
editor@wrti.org. We want to hear from you. And bonus points, if you send us a voice memo, we'll get you on the show with us via your memo. And have a great fun time.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. It's hosted by me, Nate Chenin, and Greg Bryant, and produced by Alex Arif.
Special thanks to Judy Miller-Silverman, Inez Leon, and Barbara Seely. WRTI's operation manager is Joe Patty, and assistant director of production is Tyler McClure. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson, and Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager. Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up here in Philly and beyond. We'll see you again really soon.